Tori Van Oot's kind enough to join us. Of course, Axios Twin Cities is where you'll find her. If you're not subscribed, you need to be. Tori, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How are things going over there? I know you guys, Axios is such a great news source. I know that we are one of their local metros that they've launched into. How has it been going for you?
We are so floored and thrilled by the response we've gotten. I just tweeted today that we have over 38,000 subscribers.
Wow.
Who have joined us for our free daily newsletter in the month. And anyone who wants to sign up can sign up at axios.com/local. But we're getting great feedback. And I just want to emphasize, I love reader emails and feedback. I know you love your callers and Facebook feedback too. It just helps us do our job better. So we're having fun so far, and I hope our readers are too.
It's a great way to, the way they deliver the news is just top notch. It gives you all the important details very quickly. You definitely want to follow Axios Twin Cities. And once again, we'll put out the link for everyone to go to sign up for that newsletter. It's a free newsletter and it gets you all the news you really need here. Axios, of course, a large organization. They have Axios on HBO. You posted a clip from Axios on HBO that I want to definitely talk about to start with, because I was just talking about the latest coronavirus update here in the city and in the state. You have a clip there where National Institute of Health Director Francis Collins, he lays it out there that basically the politicization of the face mask that was done by the Trump administration, That even though that he was talking out of both sides of his mouth on this. On one side, he was saying wear face masks. On the other side, he was kind of, making a mockery of it. But the reality is that we're starting to realize that politicization of that basically caused probably not only thousands of more people to get sick, but also likely quite a few more people to die as well.
Yeah, that's right. And this is something we've kind of heard from health experts and epidemiologists all along, concerns about this. And it was just the latest way of addressing it. And, we're still seeing surveys we've seen in surveys, because it's in this politicization, partisan breaks, right? With more Democrats saying that they're wearing a mask all or some of the time versus Republicans. And, we're turning the corner here on the pandemic, but this issue isn't over. What we hear over and over again from public health experts is cases are going down, vaccinations are going up, but we still need to be wearing masks to curb the spread, especially of these new variants. So, even though 2020 is behind us in some of this rhetoric, the impact could be lasting.
I think the saddest, and hands down, I actually think the saddest story from last year was the nurses in South Dakota, where they were working on the ICU wards and they had people dying and they were begging them to call loved ones to say goodbye, at least, make sure they talk to their loved ones. And the patients who were dying of coronavirus were screaming at the nurses, "This is a hoax. This isn't real." When you politicize something of this nature, I don't know if we're ever really going to be able to undo this, because this is, granted, coronavirus is the beginning of this, but the reality is that there have been people in the last 15 or 20 years or so, starting with the anti-vaxxers and stuff, who have been putting a political spin on healthcare, even though that it's more based on, whether it's hopes and wishes or looking for a culprit, but not really based on science. And, what we saw with in your, I think the article your point out here is that what we've got here is it's a perfect storm when you get to coronavirus and the pandemic, because that politicizing of the issue, it ends up, it costs people lives.
Yeah, so it's been a really difficult situation, and you're right that there might be some kind of lasting effects and impact, and maybe hopefully some lessons learned for future crises, but some of the reach of dis and misinformation was quite strong on this one, and people really dug in. But yeah, the messages, the messages that we keep on hearing again from state and federal officials is, please still wear your mask even if you've gotten vaccinated, to keep this under control. And Governor Tim Walz and the director of the Department of Public Health here in Minnesota even said this weekend and today, you know, if you want to go back to Target Field this summer, wear a mask. You know, there's this, there's our stakes here at this point, not just for public health and keeping people safe and out of the hospital and hopefully not dying of COVID, but in terms of our reopening schedule is what we're hearing from leaders, you know, helping everybody doing their part to keep cases down.
Well, and I'll say this is from what I've seen with in regards to the numbers in Minnesota, especially compared to the states surrounding us. You can't deny that Minnesota has weathered this better. I mean, we've just our per 100,000 rates on death and infections has been much lower. We've got that diagnosis rates down at what 3.6 today. That's the latest on that. So that's some good news. We also have you have a story directly out of Axios Twin Cities that talks about the Twin Cities itself. It has a bit of an economic advantage as we are hopefully looking to a brighter future down the road. We're going to be obviously looking at economic recovery. They have an economic advantage here in the Twin Cities. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is a story that my colleague Nick kind of took the lead on. But essentially, we were called out in this story from the Wall Street Journal as one of a handful of like Midwestern cities that, as you said, have done a lot better. Our unemployment rate was under 5% at the end of the year, which was lower than the national average. And really the factors are, you know, the same things that make our economy in non-pandemic times really strong, right? We have a super diverse economy. Think about all the different industries that are based here in the Twin Cities and surrounding areas in Minnesota. And there's a lot of white-collar jobs. And so all of those folks, you know, people who work in offices, lawyers, communications, banks, a lot of those people were able to still keep their jobs and just work remote really easily. We're also less reliant on tourism. So if you think about somewhere like Las Vegas or, you know, beach towns, you know, our tourism industry and our hotel industry and our hospitality industry, their struggles are real. They've been hit really hard and it's going to take a long time and a lot of support for them to recover. But they're not as big of a piece of the economic pie here as they are in some other places. So that's put us in pretty good position. Again, we still lost a lot of jobs, and a good chunk of them haven't come back. But it's brighter than here than it is in other places, which is a good thing and a credit to the economy that everybody, you know, here in Minnesota has helped build together.
You had a story, I believe it was on Saturday, and I wonder if we can tie that into here about credit scores. Uh-huh. It's shocking. How high Minnesota's credit rating is compared to everyone else. I mean, we were, 7 points ahead of the next two states, Vermont and Wisconsin. You talk about that story as well, because, I mean, are we looking at just, I mean, our economic base. It's not just the fact that we didn't have like the tourism stuff, as you just mentioned, at least not as much. Obviously, all our best to the Mall of America, because I know that they're trying to get back up and running here.
Yep.
But at the same time, we seem to have also just had pre-pandemic the right recipe of economic, you know, viability in Minnesota, which when you go back to that credit score story shows that we kind of were already in a good place to weather something like this a little bit better than other places.
Right. And just real quickly, on the Mall of America, you're right that they're, you know, in a tough spot. Their foot traffic, one estimate we found, is like down 50%. And we just saw last week they've been suing some of their tenants who can't afford rent. So, you know, things are really touch and go in a lot of this space still. But yeah, you're right. And maybe you can tell me, because I'm not a native Minnesotan. Maybe Minnesotans are just very responsible. I don't know. But according to the Credit Bureau Experian, one of the main reporting bureaus, Minnesota again topped the nation, and the credit scores went up amid the pandemic, and we're, yeah, as you mentioned, way ahead of everybody else. So that's a really good thing for, you know, financial health of citizens and ability to borrow, whether it's like a home loan or a car loan, and not have super high interest rates. It's a good thing. But yeah, maybe you have first. I have no idea what's driving this. Something about the responsibility of the Minnesotans. I don't know.
I think
y'all are good at budgeting.
Well, I think it's twofold. And I really do. And I mean, obviously, I'm about to paint with a wide brush here, and so there are obviously exceptions to all this. Yeah. But I think you mentioned it in the first story about where we're coming out economically afterwards, and understandably our lost jobs is there. But you said white-collar jobs. We have a lot of people. The jobs in Minnesota generally pay pretty well. And My wife was a corporate headhunter for a while. And, you know, the rule of thumb is this, is that the hardest city to recruit into is Minneapolis-St. Paul, but the hardest city to recruit out of is Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Huh.
So once people get here, they don't want to leave. And that is one of the things which is really remarkable, and I think you touched on it. It's generally, we have a lot of good jobs, and we have, you look at a map of Minneapolis, and I'm once again painting with a wide brush, but there's a lot of suburbs which have a lot of people living still a relatively normal middle-class life, which is not something you see, I think, in a lot of other cities. The other side of it, I'll just go, it's practical. We don't buy Lamborghinis. Okay. And I'm not going to buy that car. I can't drive it for half the year. Oh, yeah. Now, granted, I mean, we have plenty of people that have snowmobiles and boats, which generally are limited. But at the same time, I think that...
Yeah, you need loans for those, too.
Well, but I think what you do is you don't get... You know, people are practical when they buy the stuff. And so, can I afford it? That's one of those questions, which obviously goes a long way with a credit score. But well, and once again, painting with a wide brush, there's plenty of people that don't do that, that just kind of use up credit cards. But at the same time, I think there's a practicality of, oh, well, I'd sure like to have a nice car or a motorcycle, but I could only use it for 6 months, 7 months. I'm not going to do that. And that kind of is that might be helping Minnesotans right there.
Well, and cost of living here, as you mentioned, is pretty, you're not going to have the housing market here is very hot and prices are rising quickly, especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But in general, it's not like in New York or other places where it's, I mean, just totally stretching people beyond their means just to have a house in some cases. So
no, you're exactly right. And, you know, we are a good... Was it 70 points or is it 50 points? Over Mississippi is the last. I went through the numbers with the links on your story, and I was looking through there. I was like, I think Mississippi is the last. And I'm like, we're like 60 points ahead of them on a credit score.
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, how is that even possible? I mean, it really does show you that Minnesota has, you know, they've done well here. And I think you're also the diversity you bring up, too. I mean, the fact that we're not a one company town. We have so many different businesses here. And such a and many of them good paying jobs on a lot of different varieties that I think that's the diversity helps us a lot too.
Yeah, certainly, and access to credit, perhaps. Yeah, financial literacy, access to credit, that sort of thing. That was a fascinating one. We were really interested to find that.
Well, speaking of money, let's talk of Bondingville really quick. Final topic here for you, Dayton has come on out with his plans here. Nothing too outrageous. I mean, he's not exactly going for the gusto here. He actually seems to have a fairly reasonable plan. Clearly, the sticking point's going to be that he wants money to help Minneapolis-St. Paul to rebuild after what happened after George Floyd. But the Republicans, who many of them represent counties who take much more back in taxpayer dollars than they give into the system, are refusing to give Minneapolis-St. Paul money. They don't want to do that. That's kind of the political point that they're trying to make, and they're going to try to make hay out of this to the election 2022. Do you think Dayton's got any chance? Obviously, the bonding bill is more of a negotiation topic, but and generally stuff that I think has no chance to get through sometimes does get through. Is there any chance that Minneapolis-St. Paul are going to see any money out of this, do you think?
Well, as you know, like you mentioned, this is the first salvo in what is going to be a negotiation that will probably end in the wee hours of the morning in late May when the legislature is about to adjourn. So as the size and that sort of thing, you know, the legislature actually usually does a bonding bill in even number of years. We had that really big kind of record bonding bill, public construction borrowing bill last fall that the legislature reached a deal on. We have heard from legislative leaders kind of an opening and an interest in doing a little bit more bonding this year. I mean, it helps, shovel-ready projects, ensure that construction projects and things like that are going to be going, needed infrastructure investments for everything from the University of Minnesota to water treatment plants. Bonding is kind of the state version of when you have, earmarks in Congress, right? Everybody can try to get a little something for their district. So it's a hard deal to put together, but there's also often eventually support for it. You're right. The big question is these proposals to get more money to help Minneapolis and St. Paul rebuild, whether it's money for trial security reimbursements or some of this other rebuilding. There has been opposition from, including in the Senate, Republican majority And so we'll just see. But one thing to keep in mind is the legislature also has to balance the budget this year. You know, it's a constitutionally required to pass a budget bill. Bonding does require a supermajority. So you need, not only do you need Republicans in the Senate and Democrats in the House, but you also need the minority parties mm-hmm. need to chamber on board. So I think it's just one piece in this bigger puzzle that has to be finished by the end of session. It's another chip in the negotiations.
I said Dayton. It's Governor Walz, obviously.
Yeah,
Governor Walz, obviously. One of the things, though, that the Republicans have just shown on their hand, there was a lot of funds that were given to businesses to help them get through the pandemic. And I remember when those funds were being given out, the people said, make sure you hold enough money for taxes. Well, now there's stories mm-hmm. that are coming out that people are kind of, wait a minute here, we had to pay all this money in taxes. Well, first, I think that that was something that I had heard, that when people were getting this, that you just have to make sure you talk to your tax professional about how much you need to hold back for this. But, you know, the Republicans clearly are going to want Walz to sign off on some sort of tax break for these businesses. And I can tell you right now, that might be enough to sweeten the deal to get Minneapolis-St. Paul the money if they can go on out there and find a way to give maybe a tax forgiveness or at least a major discount on the taxes involved with the government aid that was sent out at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that that's a good point, that a tax conformity law could really help. As you mentioned, the issue, I think, is that some of these forgivable loans are subject to state taxes.
Yes.
There's concerns about that. Yeah, so, and we've already seen some Republican senators, I think Senator Michelle Benson was tweeting about this maybe last week or over the weekend, about how she wants, you know, the governor or the legislature to delay the collection of the tax or fix it. So that's another bargaining chip, right? And there are other tax cuts that Republicans might be interested in, other benefits for businesses, other issues. It's amazing the number of issues that legislators on both sides of the aisle can get onto the table mm-hmm. for these negotiations. But yeah, I think that will certainly be in the mix. And then on bonding, you know, there's a lot of Greater Minnesota projects that would like to see even more bonding dollars than they got last year, right? Mm-hmm. And another kind of interesting little twist on bonding is that the chair of what's essentially the bonding committee in the Senate is actually Senator Tom Bach, a former DFL leader who has now left the DFL and is caucuses as an independent and made a deal with a Republican. So, you know, look for some more support for Iron Range projects, where he's from, perhaps.
Well,
as these negotiations continue. So there's a lot of different elements at play here.
Well, and you also have to remember, too, it's not just outstate, because as you said, they need to have metro area Democrats
right.
on board with this, and they're not going to just sign off on a bunch of Iron Range and outstate projects. They're going to have to give up something. You know, I will say this is, at least with the split House and Senate, that we won't have the sneaky bills that we had under Kurt Dowd, where basically, you know, stuff was promised and they waited till the last second to try to jam it through. And when people found, wait, there's no money for Southwest Light Rail or something like that in here, then the House gavel closed and then it ended up being a nightmare. At least if this bill does come on out, it will be with eyes open on it. We'll understand what's exactly in the bill. It won't be any last second surprises, at least hopefully not.
We'll see. I mean, that was before my time, what you're referencing, but the divided legislature didn't exactly do the best job at promoting transparency about the bill, the deals that were coming together last year throughout all the special sessions. So it was often a little bit of, oh, this big bill is coming out just before we vote on it. But hopefully, since they're not in special session and they're back to the special session, there'll be the committee process. They'll be, which they did have committees before, but you know, there'll be a little bit more sunlight on it. here's hoping for that.
Oh, transparency. That's only when you're in the minority. Let's remember that. Tori Van Oot, of course, Axios Twin Cities. Tori, how does people get in touch and once again sign up for that free newsletter?
Yeah, you can go to axios.com/local and sign up for our free local daily newsletter, Axios Twin Cities. We'd love to have you.
Tori, love having you on the show. Thank you.